Item number 14, which is a briefing on pound nuts, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Commissioner Carpenter, to introduce this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I grew up commercial fishing, in the sport fishing, was involved in supplying equipment for commercial fishermen and recreational fishermen for 40 years, so I have a little bit of a background, and I'm the good, bad, and ugly that chairs the fish committee that does our best to try and sort the wheat from the chaff. So I just want to say that, and we've got a dedicated committee that tries to find a common good. So I've done a lot of research on, spent a lot of time talking to people and learning what I could about the pound net that was implanted in the Columbia River by the Wild Fish Conservancy. And I've talked on the phone and exchanged emails with Adrian Toohey a number of times, but I've not had the pleasure of meeting either one of these gentlemen yet. I will shortly. So I thought it was appropriate to share the project that they were involved in this year with no particular agenda other than to learn from what they did. And so we potentially know what they know, so we can figure out ways to move forward if we choose to in some fashion.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here today. Thank you so much for having us. I'm here today to tell you a little bit about our efforts to evaluate commercial salmon traps as stock selective fishing tools in the Lower Columbia. And with this project, we're striving to reduce bycatch mortality and issues related to hatcheries, both for the benefit of wild fish and fishermen. So I'm going to be covering quite a bit of material, so if you wouldn't mind just holding your questions till the end, that would be great.
Maybe we can introduce yourself.
Oh, I suppose I should introduce myself. I'm Adrian Toohey, biologist with Wild Fish Conservancy.
And I'm Jamie Glasgow, director of science for Wild Fish Conservancy. And like Adrian, I really appreciate this opportunity to share what we've learned over the last few years when it comes to selective fishing gears in the Lower Columbia. I think a lot of our motivation for the work we've been doing is your policies, including 3619 and the Statewide Steelhead Management Plan and the 21st Century Initiative for Salmon and Steelhead. So again, thank you.
So just to give you a little background, of course, the Columbia River was once one of the most productive salmon rivers in the world. However, with, of course, rampant overfishing, habitat loss, construction of dams, and later on hatchery production, returns are now less than one-tenth of their historical abundance, and many stocks are listed under the Endangered Species Act. And this has had some severe consequences for our commercial fishing communities. This is a photograph of Calf Lamb at Washington, where our project took place. Once a bustling commercial fishing community has now economically seen better days. But despite the decline of the resource, our commercial fishermen each year want to get out on the river and do what they've been doing for years and years. And the only gear that's really legal and available to them is the gill net. And this brings us to the challenge. Our fishermen are trying to target hatchery origin fish within the Columbia and in many other fisheries, but they're operating in a mixed stock fishery. And the gill net is a non-selective gear, and while you're trying to target hatchery origin fish, often wild fish become entangled, and this can result in bycatch mortality. So that's the main problem. And so while this impedes our wild salmon recovery, it also impedes commercial fishing opportunities. Because when ESA take limits are exceeded, fisheries can be shut down. And that also results in another problem. All these hatchery fish that we produced are then enabled to move upstream to spawn with wild fish and cause other ecological issues. So it really is quite the conundrum. And so in 2009, the commission released the Hatchery and Fishery Reform Policy Decision to develop and implement alternative fishing gear to maximize catch of hatchery origin fish with minimal mortality to native salmon and steelhead. Now, this is addressing two of the H's, harvest, by reducing bycatch mortality, and hatcheries. It's a recommendation by the HSRG, reducing genetic integration with our wild fish, and also diminishing those ecological interactions by improving targeting of hatchery origin fish. And so, as directed by the commission, DFW has done some great work taking a look at seines in the past years, and some major improvements have been made in the survival of non-target species. So gillnets frequently have post-release mortality rates ranging from 35% to 70%, depending on the fishery and the stock they're targeting. And what you're seeing here are mortality rates ranging from 50 here to, I believe, about 23% here for Chinook and Coho that are listed. So there have been some big improvements, and also for steelhead as well. So really on the right track here, and been some great work. However, we're open to new ideas, and we believe we could still go further in improving survival rates of our non-target species within the Columbia and elsewhere. So we were really pleased to see that one commercial fisherman out of Cathlamet, Washington, Blair Peterson, had a real interest in trying one of these traps out as a steelhead monitoring tool, and later as a stock selective fishing tool. And we really thought Blair was onto something. And Blair, who's here today, his grandfather was a trap fisherman, and his father was also a trap fisherman. So he was, I don't want to speak for him, but he was definitely inspired by history and his family ties, and as a merchant marine, seeing these traps operated around the world. And we really thought Blair was onto something, because this trap, it's a fixed gear, it's passive. We thought there was a lot of potential to improve survival rates because of the minimal handling that could be involved, minimal air exposure, low entanglement. And so we worked to round up some funding to help Blair perform this this test. And so in 2016, we secured the funding we needed to go ahead and help Blair to build this trap and give it a go. And so in year one, our objectives were very simple. Just as DFW had performed their studies in the past, the year one study was to just see, can we catch fish? We're building the first trap that's been built in Washington State in 80 years. So can we pull it off? Can we catch fish? And is immediate survival going to be high? So those were our goals. And in order to do this, Blair Peterson had done a lot of work investigating old blueprints of traps that had operated in the Lower Columbia, and we did our research as well, digging through the old records. And we went through hundreds of old blueprints and old accounts, and this was the design that we ended up going through with, just a very simple lead heart spiller design for a fish trap. And this was commonly used in the Lower Columbia River and was very effective in the past. So in December 2015, we repositioned some pilings, got the design just how we wanted it, and based upon that configuration, went ahead and started designing the nets, the length, the depth, and various other components of our fish trap. So building these different components, we directed down the highway to Cathlamet, Washington, where Blair Peterson and the Wild Fish Conservancy staff got to work hanging the trap. And in about 2 to 3 weeks, we had Washington State's first commercial salmon trap. And it was really quite a sight to see. It was a thrill to put it all together and just kind of a trip through history. Here's a diagram so you can get a better idea of how a fish trap works. But of course, adult fish are trying to return home to their natal tributaries and rivers. They're moving upstream along shore, and they hit this long lead of pilings. And attached to these pilings are nets that extend from the high water mark down to the down to the river or estuary bottom. And so this effectively creates a wall within the water. The fish hit this wall and try to find their way around it. And in the process, they get lost in what's called the heart. They have a hard time finding their way out. And they're driven by their natural instinct to move upstream, eventually through what's called the tunnel, and into the spiller, which is the final compartment where they were completely entrapped but free swimming. This is what the tunnel looks like. It has a wide opening, a very narrow outlet. And once the fish go through this, they cannot find their way back out. And it's pretty amazing to see. You think they would, but they can't find their way out of that tunnel. And so once that spiller has reached capacity, and you have the ability to see the fish building up in the spiller so there's no overcrowding, you can close the tunnel and then lift the bottom of this spiller. There's a mesh bottom to it. You lift the bottom of that spiller from four corners with this electric winch, and it's solar powered. Lift that up towards the water surface level. That guides the fish towards a dock that's positioned adjacent to the spiller. And then what you can do once those fish are at the water surface level is spill them out and into a live well, which is a chamber that's positioned on the dock with free-flowing river water. And then you could safely sort your hatchery fish from your wild fish, taking the hatchery fish, putting it on ice, bleeding it, and then just leaving your wild fish within the live well. And then you can open a door, and those wild fish can swim out without being handled. And so these were our results in year one. We captured over 2,100 salmonids. We had an immediate survival rate of 99.6%, which was very good. Majority of catch were coho and steelhead in this first year. Also, the majority of fish captured were of hatchery origin. Relative to seines in their first year, their pilot year of operation in 2009, the pound net actually captured more of the target species and salmonids in general, working with nearly half the run size. Immediate survival for all of these gears was less than 1%. And so our conclusions for year one was that traps can work. We pulled it off, and we were really thrilled and surprised. It was a trip through history, and we didn't really know if we could, I mean, could we do this for the first time in 80 years? We were blown away by how well it worked. Immediate survival is very high, and it was clear to us that these traps, as you'd expect, can catch commercially viable quantities of fish. So we believed further testing was warranted based upon our results. And NOAA's National Bycatch Reduction Engineering Program agreed and funded us for year two. And so, once again, following in the footsteps of DFW for their seine testing operations in 2011 and 12, we went ahead to perform what's called a post-release survival study. So after release from this gear, do these fish survive to eventually spawn? And that's the most important metric, right? And so we can estimate that by tagging fish and detecting them as they pass various dams upstream. And that's how these post-release survival studies have been conducted and how we went about it. So we identified some modifications that we could do to improve efficiency and survival. And we went about this mark recapture methodology to estimate long-term survival or cumulative survival, which is from release all the way to McNary Dam, just as DFW did it. How many of our fish survive that have been captured from the trap relative to a control source of fish that have not been captured and made contact with your nets from the trap? And so test fishing, once again, took place from August 26th through September 29th in the fall fishery. Target species were hatchery origin fall chinook, coho, and steelhead. And so our goals were to tag 2,000 chinook, 1,000 steelhead to determine the survival rates of those stocks. And once again, we were detecting survival as they passed various dams upstream. So we got to work hanging the trap once again in August. We went about our modifications. One of these was a marine mammal gate to prevent entry of marine mammals, which could cause damage to the trap or to other fish. And this turned out to be a big success. We're definitely on the right track with this marine mammal gate. We also modified the spiller, reducing the mesh size. We had 9 coho jack mortalities the previous year. We wanted to eliminate that to 0. And so we reduced that mesh size, and also the way in which the spiller moved up and down within the water column. And by having our spiller move up and down along some steel cables instead of along an aluminum pole, we reduced the friction of this of the spiller, and we really enabled the spiller to be flush with the river bottom. When you're fishing a trap, you want to make sure all your nets are flush with the river bottom. Otherwise, you miss those deep water species like the Chinook. And so this year, we were really pleased to see the proportion of Chinook salmon increase dramatically as a result of these nets truly being flush to the river bottom. So we're learning a lot as we go along this whole process. So once again, we got to fishing on August 26th, and this time we tagged our fish with a biomark tagger, and we had a pit tag reader, so that information could go directly into our computer database. We'd flip the fish upside down, cover its eyes. That calms the fish. You're able to tag it and gather a fin clip, and that's to determine if these fish are really destined to head above Bonneville Dam or not, so to see if they're veering off before they get to the dam. This would go into our computer database, the fin clip number, and the pit tag number. And then we'd let the fish recover and send it on home to continue its migration. So here was our capture and release point down around Kathlamet, Washington, River Mile 42. And our marker for short-term survival was Bonneville Dam. Long-term survival, that was McNary Dam. And these markers were chosen by DFW. We're just mirroring their study. Just for reference, the purse seines, when they were operating, they were operating just shy of Bonneville Dam, around River Mile 140. So we actually were at about a 100-mile disadvantage with our study, the hypothesis being the further you are downriver, the more chance fish release from your trap or whatever gear might perish. So these were our results. With our modifications, we are incredibly pleased to see that the efficiency of the trap increased dramatically with just about the same amount of test fishing days, same amount of time on the water. We captured nearly 7,100 salmonids, so more than tripling catch. And the proportion of Chinook increased dramatically with our modifications. So here you see coho and Chinook leading the pack. Here was our catch per unit effort, so catch per hour, essentially. And just comparing this to the average gillnetter's catch per unit effort, so catch per hour, in the Columbia, the trap had captured 3 times the amount of that of a gillnetter catch per unit effort. As for survival, we were incredibly pleased to see that Chinook survived at a 99.8% survival rate. Now, that's cumulative survival from release from our trap to McNary Dam, 99.8% survival. Now, the relative survival for steelhead was also excellent, nearly 96%. So we were absolutely thrilled. And for Chinook, I mean, it's a massive, massive improvement over all existing years. For steelhead, it's equivalent or greater. So in conclusion here, from our results, it's clear that traps are efficient as you'd expect based upon history. It's no surprise they're very efficient. They also have very high survival rates when you modify them and regulate them. So the bottom line is, the pound net trap, it's a viable, stock-selective commercial fishing tool. So we have that identified. Now, how does this fit into our long-term vision? Basically, our goal is to create a working model for sustainable salmon fisheries based around use of sustainable gears. We want to create a sustainable working model that's economically attractive and economically attractive to the fishermen. And we believe there's sort of a seven-step process to this. The first step we've basically done. We've identified a gear that works very well. Now that we have an alternative that does work, and there could be others out there as well, you need to develop trap-specific regulations to keep it sustainable. Because as we know, traps in the past were incredibly efficient, and there was a lot of overfishing. So you need to regulate it, for example, limit how long a lead could be, among many other things. So develop these regulations specific to the gear. And then, of course, if you're ever going to have a transition to alternative gears, which I think is that's what everybody is thinking is going to happen into the future, we're going to have to legalize an alternative at some point. With a gear like a trap, we envision it working very well in a co-op setup. I mean, these gears are incredibly efficient. We're currently fishing in what's widely known as it's a steelhead hole. It's not a great spot to be fishing. But if you put this in a better spot, it would be pretty remarkable, I'm guessing, as to the efficiency. So we envision multiple fishermen, you know, maybe up to even six, working together on a trap. And then, of course, this isn't easy. This is a big change, but a change that needs to happen over time. We need to advocate and help fishermen transition, some sort of trade system. There's a lot we need to think about there. And, of course, we need to make it profitable and attractive, and I think that's very, very achievable. With a sustainable gear that reduces bycatch mortality, you could have increased harvest opportunities. If you have a gear that really reduces bycatch mortality, you could fish for longer and more consistently. And also with a trap, you can fish more efficiently. For the first time, a gear in the Columbia might be able to be sustainably certified. And that's really big. Sustainable market certification increases the price for the fishermen. And also that affects demand. For example, in Puget Sound, Chinook salmon, it's been labeled red, and that's the gillnet fishery for Chinook salmon. Once it was labeled red, those fishermen have been having a really hard time selling their fish. So sustainable certification affects demand. We also want to encourage best harvest practices. Bleeding the fish, putting them on ice directly, helps get you a higher price point per pound. We envision a local ice house, local processing. Also, with this trap, it has a very low carbon footprint. And right now, that might not sound like much, but sustainable certification, the qualifications for that are continuously getting more rigorous. So this is going to be the greenest gear out there. So we want to encourage best harvest practices, and really some savvy marketing and help make this lucrative for the fishermen and good for the wild fish. Once we have this working model that is sustainable and profitable for the fishermen, we want to apply this to other fisheries. I mean, there are many other mixed stock fisheries with harvest issues and hatchery issues, and this model can be applied in so many other places. So the broader implications are really sweeping and dramatic. Now, these are the benefits consistent with C3619. Wild salmon recovery, so increased survival and escapement of non-target stocks, so wild fish, by reducing bycatch mortality. Efficient removal of hatchery fish and reduced genetic and ecological impacts, as recommended by the HSRG. And realization of habitat restoration benefits. the more wild fish we have returning to spawn, and the better their fitness. For the first time, taxpayers might actually see the benefits of all their contributions to habitat restoration. Also, coastal community revitalization. With this trap and a sustainable gear that reduces bycatch mortality, these fishermen can have more time on the water fishing, and same with the tribes. More fish in the water as well. And of course, as I said, with sustainable certification, you can get a higher price per point per pound, and that also does affect demand. Ultimately, by rejuvenating the commercial fishing industry, that'll have a ripple effect through the economies of our working waterfront communities. And we hope to develop lasting, sustainable wild fisheries. That's our entire goal here for the future. So to achieve this working model that I had described, it's going to take a little bit of time, as you can imagine. And so in 2018, we hope to bridge the gap and fill in some important data gaps. So one of these steps is determining the feasibility of traps in spring Chinook, shad, and summer Chinook fisheries. And why are we doing this? Well, it's to diversify the portfolio for fishermen. You can't just have a trap operating in the fall fishery. That isn't going to work. A fisherman needs a diverse portfolio of fisheries to be involved in to be truly successful. So we want to try this in the spring Chinook fishery and the shad fishery. We could identify new profitable markets. We have this invasive shad resource in the Columbia and plenty of it. Why don't we try to reduce the impact of these invasive fish and identify potentially a market that could be a game changer? So that's what we hope to do in 2018. We, of course, need to secure research funding, obtain the required research permits, and take coverage, and identify the successes and failures and the required modifications in each fishery to make this a success in the future. Another step for 2018 is joining the Lower Columbia Alternative Gear Emerging Fall Fishery that has operated in the past. So currently, the Sains have been operating within this emerging fishery. It's a step to help the transition to alternative gears. And why are we doing this? We're hoping to bridge the gap prior to legalization, just as those Sains are doing. Currently, seines and traps are illegal, so this is a logical step prior to its legalization, which could take a number of years. We need to demonstrate the economic potential. So we need to operate this gear in a fishery, bring fish to market, and demonstrate that it is profitable and reduce uncertainty for investors. I mean, fishermen need to know that the state's behind this. The fishermen need to know the state's behind alternative gears such as traps to make it something they're willing to invest in. Because if the state's not in support of it, why would you invest in it? So it's very important to reduce the uncertainty for potential investors. So we need to attain an emerging fisheries permit and license for the fall of 2018, commercially operate the trap and bring fish to market. And of course, we can gather additional data and monitor the trap while we're at it. And of course, all of this is to build a foundation for a successful legal fishery. We need to identify challenges of bringing fish to market for the first time, build crucial relationships with other fishermen, processors, marketers, buyers, and consumers. And as we're going about these next steps, we need to be applying and securing federal funds to build the other components of this model that I was talking about. So these are our needs in 2018. We need to secure funding and the state and federal permits for the spring through summer feasibility studies that I just addressed. We need to acquire an emerging fisheries permit and license for the fall of 2018 fishery. And We need to obtain letters of support for other state, federal, and foundation grant proposals. All this research really couldn't have been possible without our funders, NOAA Fisheries Service, the BREP, the Washington Coastal Restoration Initiative, Patagonia Provisions, and of course, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And of course, Blair Peterson was absolutely instrumental in all of this. He's really dedicated a lot of time thinking about this trap and just couldn't do it without Blair. That's everything. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Very similar, a lot of it, to reef netting, isn't it?
Without having to depend on water clarity from above.
Exactly. And in fact, a lot of the modifications we made to the trap were based off the Lummi Island reef net fishery. They're really onto something there.
Yeah, they are. And with the savvy marketing and the sustainability stuff, the Lummi Island Wild's been growing a lot.
Yeah. It's huge. We think that's a great model. And in fact, we're trying to, you know, eventually adopt a very similar model and, of course, apply that elsewhere.
Yeah. They're marketing internationally, as you know now. I mean, that's Pink's, you know, internationally. So, thank you. We'll open up for questions. We'll start down at that end and move on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been on the commission 6 years now. This was the most amazing and hopeful presentation on the salmon issues that I've heard. And I want you to understand the magnitude in my eyes anyway, I don't know about the rest of the commissioners, that this is groundbreaking as far as I can see in coming to some type of solution. And I'm sure there's problems, there's going to be things to work out. But truly amazing, you know, that you've met the requirements of wild fish and are considering the needs of the commercial fleet. There's things to be worked out, and I don't know, like you say, these co-ops are going to be tough things to get going, but I just want to say I have not heard a presentation to date that is of this significance, and I don't want that to be lost on you and especially on the commission. This isn't, to me, something that just, oh, that was a great presentation, and on we go. I'd like to see the slide of the three things you need back up, if possible, and for us to discuss that a little bit. What are we going to do to make this happen or assist this in happening? Because I think it's groundbreaking. And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. One on the applicability to a full fleet, so to speak, fishery. And one question on your survival rates. It looked like there were some pilings in there, and let me just go through this, and then maybe you can answer. Pilings can sometimes be considered kind of permanent things. They're not necessarily cheap to put in, and they're expensive, and so. In terms of an applicability to all those folks who might have a Columbia River gillnet license now, are there any sort of transient models out there that I've heard about some things in Alaska anyway, fish trap type of things? I'm not sure if the northern reef net situations have so much permanency to them. But how much did the pilings cost? Is there a transitional thing that could be used, and do you see something that's cost effective for an individual who currently has a Columbia River gillnet license to get into this on a personal basis, or, you know, a couple of helpers basis, as opposed to something that has to be shared amongst 20 gillnet licenses?
Great question. So a trap, you could build the trap that we constructed for $90,000 to $100,000. Now, if you compare that to, you know, buying a gill netter and all of your nets, you know, frequently a gill net boat and all the nets, it'll run you, you know, at the low end, $40,000, but, you know, also much, much higher depending on the boat. And, of course, you have fuel costs on top of that and everything. So this really isn't that far off. And as you saw from some of our slides there, the efficiency of these traps is remarkable. You look back at history, it's amazing what these things can do, especially when put in the right spot. We're currently in a steelhead hole, and it's catching as much or more than 3 gill netters for catch per unit effort. So one trap we envision can be operated by many fishermen, and they can invest together. I don't see one trap being operated just by solely by one fisherman. I mean, this could accommodate the needs of many. Does that answer your question?
That does. Is there any transient trap options out there where someone would not have to rely on pilings, but could be a seasonal situation? You know, some of the problems with the old fish traps were they worked great on the year where the river was high, and then they were up in the bushes when the river was low and didn't catch anything. But is there a transient option where you don't have to put pilings in?
Well, in the past, there were many, many floating traps. I mean, those were incredibly effective in Alaska, especially later on. In places where you have quite a bit of current, pile traps were most common because they could resist those flows and stay anchored. But floating traps were incredibly effective, and I would love to see this tested in the future. It could be pulled off, absolutely. I have no doubt in my mind that floating traps could be pulled off.
I'm sorry to interrupt. If I could add just a few things as well. Very very good question. I mean, that is really the million-dollar question, right? How do we get from having demonstrated that this gear can work to a working model? And there, you know, we identified seven steps, right? That sounds easy, but it's not. And it's, you know, this is a big change. You know, not just in the gear, but even just in the way we think about fishing. And it's something we all think about quite a bit. And so it's going to take some work to get from A to B on this. I want to be clear that we're not underestimating this. We don't have any misconception that this is a simple thing to do. And that's why we really need your help and the department's help to make this happen. To your question about a model as far as what this might look like, I do think the reef nets, Lummi Island Wild is a really good model, and maybe the closest thing that we have to look at. We've been working with them over the last several years. We've helped them get their gear certified through the Seafood Watch Monterey Bay Aquarium as sustainable, and that really has helped them actually expand their market. So there's a lot that we see with the Lummi Island Wild model that we think is very applicable to the Lower Columbia and elsewhere. And I want to be clear about that too. This, you know, we're using fixed piles in the Columbia because that seems to be the gear style that works very effectively and efficiently there. But different environments would and could accommodate different types of traps. There certainly would be areas where a floating trap would make more sense than a fixed gear, and that would give you more versatility to address the variability that you're describing. There's absolutely opportunities to use selective gears like these traps in other areas like the Willapa, like Puget Sound, where the same needs exist as far as being more capable at sorting fish and releasing non-target fish unharmed.
Thank you. My question on the survival rate, 99.8% obviously is a dazzling survival rate. So your picture indicated you were taking some sort of fin sample to sort out how many fish went to the North Fork of the Lewis. I mean, there's upriver bright genetic strains, I think, at Bonneville Hatchery and spawn below Bonneville Dam. So sorting out those fish that aren't going to make it to McNary Dam must be a considerable challenge. I mean, upriver brights in the Deschutes River, for example, or the Klickitat River, that kind of survival rate is almost better than some of the old dam studies where all they were doing was trying to test whether fish could find fish ladders between Bonneville, the Dalles, John Day, and McNary. So if the question gets too detailed to answer, I can catch up with you later. But it's a very curious thing on how did you sort out all those turnoffs to get that statistic?
That's an excellent question. And so this is we're mirroring the methodology of Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's a relative survival study. So you're comparing survival of the treatment, which is that's fish captured in the trap, to that of a control. So fish tagged that were not affected by your gear type. So it's relative to a control. So obviously there are fish peeling off to different tributaries, but you tag a great, great number of fish. So it's by having a very large sample size of control and treatment. That's how you address that concern, and also through by taking fin clips. So you can see what proportion of the fish are actually destined to head, veer off before Bonneville or before McNary. So you address that with the fin clips and the very large sample size, and that it enables you to effectively estimate survival relative to a control source of fish, just as DFW did.
If I could add to that once more, we have a full report from the year one, the 2016 research. We just pulled the nets off the trap earlier this month for the 2017 work. We are still working through the data, and we'll have a full report on the 2017 research that will go into more detail than most will care to see about what we did and why and what we found and what we've learned and what the implications are. So that's something we'll be sure to share with you all once we have it.
And we have a report due to NOAA. There's a progress report in December. The final report's due in June. I'm also working with the University of Washington. John Skalski, who's done tons of great work in the Columbia Basin, and Tom Quinn. I'm working on a master's thesis around this. So there's a lot of great people involved. And we hope to publish this in peer-reviewed scientific journals and everything.
And Mr. Chairman, just let me quickly echo the thanks to you all for an excellent study here of some major significance and a demonstration of how a good partnership would work with the local industry.
Thank you so much.
I also thank you and thank Larry for bringing this to us. Commissioner McIsaac basically asked my questions, but I do want to get a little bit more clarity on the survival analysis, because, as he said, that's a dazzling figure. About a year ago, before Commissioner McIsaac came on, we were presented with a reanalysis of the same study because those biases were not included. Are you saying that you included the biases up front in terms of the fish turning off and everything, and did not mirror the original study and analysis?
Right. So by taking these fin clip samples, that's addressing one of those biases that was brought up and was an issue with DFW. Okay. So Fish and Wildlife were captured and dip netted from the Bonneville adult facility there from the fish ladder. They were then anesthetized, put into a truck downstream a number of miles to where the seines were operating, and then they were released. So it's actually, that's a fairly stressful experience, as you can imagine. I mean, a fish that's already gone through that journey, dip netted, put in a truck, brought back and released. And it's a very tough situation, because how do you get your control fish? So ideally, a control source of fish, it's free swimming fish moving up the Columbia, never touched by another gear. And essentially, you in a perfect world, the hand of God would reach down and pit tag this fish as it's moving up the river. So that's obviously not going to happen. And so Fish and Wildlife was doing their best, taking fish from the adult facility, capturing them, putting them in a truck, bringing them downstream. And what we did was with this trap, which is pretty neat, these fish you could see them funneling through a narrow space, and you're actually able to dip net this free swimming fish as it's funneled without making contact with your nets. You could dip net that, and that's, as you can imagine, a lot less stressful than probably being trucked around and everything. So we had our control just right there at our trap site. We were able to get these fin clips, which addresses that source of bias. And going back to DFW's study, part one of the issues was that their control source of fish, those fish were already destined to move above Bonneville Dam. Where their treatment, they weren't necessarily destined to head above Bonneville Dam. These fish ran, so control and treatment were randomized sufficiently. So that also helps address that issue. Does that answer your
question? Yeah, it does. Thank you. And just likewise, I'm very interested in the sort of operability, and you've clearly thought it through, but just a really blunt question, what's your impression of how many of these traps could be operated on the Lower Columbia? Do you have?
That's a great question. Yeah, that really is a great question. And we envision, you know, multiple fishermen working together. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot to think through. But, you know, I haven't gone out and surveyed all of the different sites where they could be placed. But we are excited to build this model. We think there's a lot of room in the Cathlamet Channel to build our working model. And then we need to work together and figure everything out.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to personally thank both of you gentlemen for what I think is a very enlightening presentation, and look forward to hearing more in the future. The other thing I just want to mention, I'm sure you probably already figured out, when you get your annual reports done, if we could make sure we get them to Tammy so that we can get those, that would be really helpful. I have two quick ones, and you can answer them as you see fit. What kind of permitting issues are needed? Is it, you know, Corps of Engineers, blah, blah, blah? That's one issue. And then I want to go back to Commissioner Keeney's comments about this slide. I guess I'd like to pose a question to the director. I know, Bill, you've had a lot of experience on the Columbia River. Where are we today, potentially, on those three items listed there for 2018? You guys want to take the permitting quickie if you can, and then?
Sure. As you can imagine, permitting the first fish trap in 80 years was a bit of a daunting process for everybody involved. Nobody knew what a fish trap was, what we were doing. But, I mean, it was, I think Army Corps was confused, DNR was confused. So it was really, you know, the first time anybody had gone through that process in some period of time, and it's currently in illegal gear. So it was a bit of a challenge. But yeah, of course, you need your permission from DNR, the Army Corps, Fish and Wildlife, you know, NOAA. Hopefully in the future, we can expedite this process. And I'm sure now that it's been done, it'll be easier moving on. But yeah, you're right. It was no easy task.
Did you want to say something, Bill?
Yeah, I'd like to hear some about this slide, about these three items, so I have some vision of where we are, where we can be. And
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. Provide just a little bit of very initial staff perspective on these requests. First off, first time we've seen them. Thank you for giving us this kind of early warning. Really appreciate that. Agree completely with the characterization on the permits. I think it's largely doable in terms of permitting, given our experience. But moving into spring, summer will pose a few new challenges. Funding, I think you're all aware of what we've been able to contribute in the past, and I doubt we'll be able to even do as much there. But I think the study design that they're putting forward, certainly the fact that they were able to get some of the NIMFS money, I think is very hopeful, and their results, I think, should help prime that as well. And we'll certainly be as supportive as we can with letters of support and other work on that. I think the real challenge that I haven't even really started to think about, and I want to spend some time talking to the director and others, will be that middle bullet and the emerging fisheries permit and license for the fall 2018 fishery. That's one that's going to really require some agency thought. So again, appreciate the early heads up on that. Understand completely why they're asking for that. It does answer some of the questions that we've been hearing from industry, which is, this looks great on paper, but it's a long ways from paper to a fish ticket that actually can provide a living. So, worth getting to.
Thanks, Bill.
I'd like to make a few comments, too, and I think these are things that I'm sure you all have thought about extensively while you're sitting in that little camp at the trap, but it's like a farmer in his tractor thinking of all the things to fix the world. But just a couple things that seem are obvious questions to me is it's a big change, and these things are efficient, extremely efficient, and that should surprise no one because they were made illegal at one time. I mean, that's so we know that this methodology works. But one of the things that really challenges me is, of course, these are mixed stock fisheries, and lots of this production is upriver, and a heck of a lot of that production is done to provide recreational fisheries clear into Idaho. And, they will not be altruistic and produce fish for us to provide an extremely efficient commercial fishery below Bonneville. They're going to want to pass their fish up. And I understand probably that people think that, and it may be true, that if we eliminated all hatchery fish, eventually we would have a wild fish utopia, and there would be enough wild fish to provide for a recreational upriver fishery. That may be true, maybe not. There's been a lot of habitat damage upstream, mm-hmm. And there's a reason we have hatcheries in some places. So those are considerations I think about. I think about this kind of a fishery, and you talk about a half a dozen people being involved in a co-op. We have, 150 gillnetters now that are making at least a partial living off of this. So because it's such an efficient fishery, you would dramatically reduce the people involved. Now, whether you shifted those to commercial fishery or the operators that were buying the fish and icing them and all of that, I think that there would be some, exchange in values and all of that. So I don't know how that would all work out. But lots of things to think about. One of the obvious things to me is, we have several fish traps on the Columbia River at every dam. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to the point of making a commercial fishery out of fish traps, you could do the same thing at Bonneville Dam and harvest fish right there. And you could wand them all and let Idaho fish pass and take hatchery fish. And so essentially, it's kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah.
In a way. That would be the most efficient fishery that we could have above Bonneville is to take the fish at the dams right now. We're not doing that for a whole laundry list of reasons. And lots of it's based on, the development and the economic impact of recreational fisheries upstream, at least mm-hmm. partially. Not to mention an incredible tribal interest in upstream terminal fisheries and development of hatcheries, their own hatcheries, and their uses. So I'm not trying to throw cold water on anything. I think you guys have done great work. I thoroughly enjoyed this presentation, but lots of people will come out of the woodwork to debate and talk about this this kind of operation. We did try to do the Willapa fish trap, and people came not out of the woodwork. The same people we knew would show up to talk about that kind of methodology, and I think that. Lots of things to talk about before this could be implemented on a grand scale, but I do appreciate the work, and I really appreciate the benefits that you could have for providing increasing survival rates to wild fish.
Well, let me just try to address a few of those here. Of course, this trap is currently in the Columbia system. However, we have many, many mixed stock fisheries with harvest and hatchery issues all across Washington State and throughout the Pacific Northwest. So, of course, you know, there are dams upstream and obviously many, many fisheries further upstream that we want to keep viable as well. But my point there is that this technology, while it's being tested in the Columbia, is applicable in so many other places where there aren't dams upstream to address mixed stock harvest issues. So we think this is incredibly valuable and could be incredibly valuable in many, many other fisheries. As for the the issue of, you know, there's lots of other fisheries upstream that we're hoping to have, you know, continue to be viable as well. We do have quotas for different regions of the river for harvest. So I can't imagine that all the fish would just be completely harvested in one region. You know, we do have these quotas for these different parts of the river. And then for, yeah, there's a lot of fishermen to accommodate. We're not saying that the fish trap is the only tool. I mean, there could be a lot of other viable alternatives out there, and we need to identify them. We need to test them. We got to prove that there are other gears out there, and I'm looking forward to that. But, you know, if you actually could have, say, four or five fishermen, six fishermen operating a trap, you wouldn't necessarily need, you know, 100 traps. You could have 25 traps, 40 traps, whatever it might be, and that could actually accommodate those fishermen.
If I could add as well, Director Ainsworth, thank you for reminding us of the range of challenges that we'll be facing together in the coming years. Just to reiterate something briefly that Adrian mentioned, you know, I do think, and this was one of the points we made during the presentation, it's going to be really important that in addition to developing the gears, we're developing a set of regulations that go along with those gears. This is different than most fisheries exist now. And those regulations to keep the fishery sustainable are going to be critical. We shouldn't penalize a gear because it is so efficient. That means we can control who catches what, where. And that just will require us to be more thoughtful about that than perhaps we have been. We really need to innovate. You know, at this point in history, we have to change how we've been fishing, and where we fish, and what gears we use. You see the forecasts, and probably they keep you up at night even more than they keep me up at night. And there's a lot of uncertainty. The trends are not good. And we cannot think that we can continue to do things the way we have always done them. And I know you get that because you have policies and initiatives to address the need for selective gears. I feel like now we have several gears that have proven themselves to be effective, and we really need to move this forward with an emergent fisheries permit for the trap, so that we don't just continue to talk about these things and we actually make them happen, because the clock is running on our wild fish.
Thanks. I'll some of my questions have already been asked. Appreciate the presentation. You know, I've seen bits and pieces of this through some of the emails to the commission, but good to meet you guys and hear your presentation. So one of the conclusions that you made, I think after year one, was that the fish trap was commercially viable. You caught a commercially viable number of fish. I guess my question to you is, what's your definition of commercially viable?
Well, I think, as you could see from our figure of catch per unit effort. You know, we're hoping to catch at least as many fish as, you know, existing years. And I think, as you can see, you know, the trap can capture three times more fish than a gillnetter in 2017. But, you know, this is our second year of operation, and it's a fish trap. This is going to be, this gear is incredibly effective. And from our work, I think it's, you know, just operating out of a steelhead hole. I think there is so much potential, and it's proven itself commercially viable, as in it could capture more fish than a gillnetter, many more, three times the quantity. And so I'm not concerned about the number of fish that the trap can catch.
Let me just to play devil's advocate, and it's not just the number of fish that you catch, it's the costs that you incur to catch those fish, right? So that's, mm-hmm. you know, that needs to be built in. The other kind of question related to the permit issue for driving these pilings, I think I heard you say that it was $100,000 to build this trap. Does that include the cost of securing these permits and going to different agencies, perhaps hiring consultants and or people to help you through that process?
So, no, it does not.
Okay. Just two more items. You mentioned the encounters of steelhead, very low encounters. The survival of steelhead. But I did not see, and probably as you know, one of the limitations that we've come across with beach seines in particular is, you know, really great survival of the steelhead, but on the other hand, very high encounter rates. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, what was your experience in terms of encounter rates? Because to get mortalities, you need encounters plus survival.
Right, and as I said before, we're in a well-known steelhead fishing hole. So we did have a good number of steelhead encounters, for sure. But yeah, with our very high survival rates, should address that concern.
Okay. Well, I'd be curious to see more information, because that is a real limiting factor that we found with the alternative gears, at least preliminary, the data. And one last thing, just a little suggestion, is I would be cautious about talking about the added value to the fishery. I mean, you've got some commercial fishermen in the room. They can tell you right now what price they're getting for Chinook X vessel that isn't MSC certified. You know, I mean, I'm in a fishing business. I don't pretend to understand or know the dynamics of the market. You need to be, one suggestion is be careful about how much you advertise that, because some people that know a lot more than I do would be kind of question that. So just one suggestion.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. And you know, we've been really looking up to the Lummi Island fishery, and, you know, they've been very pleased with the prices they've been receiving for their fish.
That's a pink salmon fishery, though. I mean, that's they're
chum
able to kind of...
And coho. And,
yes, but...
If I could, that's exactly why we need to take this next step with the emerging fishery. I mean, that's a very valid point, and really the best way to get some data to base a statement like that off of is to go through that step. That's exactly what we want to do in the fall of 2018.
Thanks, guys. And again, cautious in the time, we do have a number of items left to go. So, Barbara, did you want to say anything? Okay, Dave, did you have anything?
My only comment is I really appreciate, you know, excellent presentation. As you know, we're looking at alternative gears, part of our process with Columbia River policy. So, and I'll say this is the most viable presentation we've had on potential alternative gears, and so I do appreciate this very much.
Thank you.
Then you can wind us up there.
Okay. Couldn't agree more with my colleague. This was one of the better presentations when it comes to fisheries. I have to agree with Jim, because where I live, as far away as you can get and still be in the state of Washington, and we have a very big steelhead fishery and salmon fishery. And without the hatchery fish, we are what you deem SOL, because that's what we fish on, our hatchery fish. Jim has a very valid point that we need. But on the flip side of the efficiency, you hate to see him get caught, throw it back in, and die. So if we can get our efficiencies down just exactly what you're saying, to where we're not killing fish, and I thoroughly agree with it, we need to keep the commercial industry viable. So if we can, we've got a lot of work ahead, but I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing and starting the debate, and I think it's on us is to do everything we can to expedite this and help it along, because I look at the industries I'm in, logging is nothing what it was when I started 40 years ago. It's a whole new world. So to think that just because this is the way that Grandpa did it, this is the way I'm going to do it, nah, you're going to be out of business. So we've got to look at all this kind of stuff. So thank you.
Great. And we do have, for any follow-up commissioners that want more information, we do have the contact info for you guys. And
we'll make sure you do, and we're going to be sending you that report once we get
Great.
It. And there's also a video or two that we're putting together to show how the operation works, which
yeah,
I think will be helpful.
I'm viewing this as the beginning of the dialogue. So
us as well.
That's why.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
We can go into more depth later, too.
Sounds great.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the
very interesting.
So much.
And also, for the commission, if next summer, if you want to come up and have a tour of the Lummi Island Wild facilities, I can set that up and see a reef net in operation. If you haven't seen it, it's cool.
I want to tour it there.
You used to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, we do both. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.